Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, and also, with a tap of the gavel, we'll open the House Committee on Senate Revenue, Joint Committee. And Paul, where are we as far as procedures this morning?
The House Committee on Revenue will also come to order. And Mr. Werner?
Okay. So the committees are technically meeting simultaneously, so you're both open to the public hearing on information. Your agenda today is to have the governor's staff come and talk about the governor's overall fiscal policy, revenue policies, to give you kind of an overview as part of the orientation process. Of course, we'll be seeing some bills that will come from that, from the governor's budget here during the session. So we've asked them to come by, and they've put together a presentation for us.
Now, great.
Good morning. Chair Barnhart and Chair Deckard, members of the committee, good morning to you all. My name is Chip Terhune. I'm the governor's chief of staff, and I have to tell you it's a pleasure actually being here this morning with all of you. I will tell you the legislature seems to be off to a fast start, and we are happy to be partnering with you and endeavoring, and look forward to a great working relationship over the course of the next weeks and months. I want to share with you that I'm also very pleased to be sitting with two people next to me. This is quite the team. It really makes you elevate your game in many respects. Tim Nesbitt and Alan Alley. So just want to share that with you. Also wanted to just talk, if I could, briefly, that it means a lot to the governor, and it means an awful lot to us in the governor's office to be able to share with you some of the thoughts and, I guess, philosophies and approaches around revenue this morning. This is an incredibly important topic, and I think one that, frankly, deserves a tremendous amount of careful attention. So we appreciate the invitation. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to open up with a very brief overview, and then I'm going to turn it over to Tim to talk about one illustration of sort of the guiding principles that have been applied at the governor's office. And then Jim Sager actually is going to be joining us momentarily. He's testifying in the room next to us. And then Alan's going to sort of be the closer, if you will, a role that I think he's probably very familiar with. The governor's general principles, I think, can be probably described in really three ways. The first one is prudence. The second one would be fairness. And the third would be targeted to critical investments. I tried to reduce that third one down to one word. I guess you could just say targeted if you wanted to. But I think all three of those principles apply. Prudence is really also used. I mean, the buzzwords out there are sustainability, stability, kind of a variety of those. But really the premise is the implication is that it's a measured, thoughtful, and appropriate approach to revenue issues. An example of prudence, I think, in the governor's budget is the fact that the proposed budget actually demonstrates a path toward what we think is perhaps the most substantial savings and reserves in probably six biennia, based on what we've looked at. That would be an example of prudence. Fairness is the second criteria, and clearly any revenue proposal that you're looking at needs to be viewed through that lens as well. As you know, Oregon's system is a series of inequities, and those need to be sort of weighed as you move forward. And I think that you'll hear, again, illustrations of how that principle gets applied in some of the conversations we've had. And then the last one is very simply targeted to critical investments. And you want to make sure that the revenue streams that are being proposed have an intrinsic link, if you will, to the policies that they're supporting, very simply. So that three-part framework, I hope, is useful as we kind of move through this and then look forward to the kind of open discussion, because I think that's really probably the heart of this meeting today, if I understand things correctly. So with that, Tim?
Thanks, Chip. For the record, I'm Tim Nesbitt. I'm one of the two deputy chiefs of staff in the governor's office, and I would like to talk a little bit more about that third principle that Chip was describing, and that is what I would call the ability to support critical investments over time. We look at this principle in two parts, in terms of our tax policies, who pays, how much, and for how long, and in terms of our investments, how we spend our money and what we get for it over time. You're very well used to dealing with that, both in this committee and in your Ways and Means committees. The governor's proposal, I want to give you a case in point now with the tobacco tax proposal. Our proposal to raise cigarette and tobacco taxes offers, I think, an example of a win-win opportunity, and it's informed by two principles. One is raising this tax in and of itself will reduce costs in our public and private health care systems. Two, using this tax to expand health coverage and health services for children will bring in new money from the feds for our local economy, pay for more health care for more people, especially preventive services for children, and reduce costs in our private health care system. And in the long run, children who have access to health, dental, and mental health care obviously will do better in school. All the data shows that. And they're more likely to thrive as they mature. But let me address first the immediate payoffs in this instance. With the failure of Measure 30 in 2003, we became the only state in the country to actually reduce tobacco taxes in this decade. More importantly, we were forced to reduce funding for tobacco education and prevention programs. And in the years that followed, we saw an increase in tobacco usage in Oregon compared to continued declines in other states. According to data from the state epidemiologist, Dr. Melvin Cohn, per capita consumption of cigarettes increased 1.5% in Oregon between 2004 and 2005, while declining 4.7% in the rest of the country. And also between 2003 and 2004, smoking during pregnancy increased 4.2% in Oregon, while declining 4.7% in the U.S. as a whole. These are not good trends for our public and private healthcare systems. And to quote Dr. Cohen, tobacco use during pregnancy is a risk factor for low birth weight, preterm labor, childhood asthma, and sudden infant death syndrome. The campaign for tobacco-free kids has compiled data by which they estimate that the healthcare costs of smoking amount to $11.16 per pack, for each pack of cigarettes. Our tax is $1.18 per pack. With that margin there, the cost to our state's healthcare economy from smoking and use of tobacco products amounts to $1 billion a year, some $250 million of that cost is our cost to the state's Medicaid program. In Washington State, the tax on a pack of cigarettes is $2.02, 84.5 cents higher than Oregon's. We believe it makes no sense to be the bargain basement for cigarettes in the Northwest. And here's what an increase in our tobacco tax rates to match those in effect in Washington State would produce in Oregon, according, again, to the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Smoking among children would decline by 12.7%. 15,100 adult smokers would quit. 29,400 kids who would otherwise become smokers would not do so. And the number of smoking-affected births would decline by 3,850 in Oregon over the next 5 years. And the long-term health care savings from this decline in smoking among youth and adults would be $658 million. If you could budget for these outcomes in your direct expenditures for services, with that kind of return on investment, I think you'd be happy to do so. This is the opposite of a tax expenditure, but it accomplishes a similar purpose. It's a tax investment. And as I mentioned earlier, this tax investment will be compounded by using the proceeds of the tax for further investments in our healthcare system. For every dollar you invest in healthcare for children in low-income and modest-income families, you stand to gain at least another $1.50 from the feds. And those investments will pay off in ever greater returns from healthier children who are better able to learn and more likely to grow up to become productive adults. Sustainability suggests more than a steady state. It requires wise use of our resources to produce ever better outcomes and greater social and economic returns over time. In fact, we hope that the receipts from our tobacco tax decline over time. The tax would be doing its job if fewer people smoke, and those who do come closer to covering the cost of their tobacco usage. In the meantime, this is a tax we believe that we should manage to minimize smoking and to maximize our investments in the health of our people, especially our children.
Good morning. For the record, I'm James Sager with the Governor's Office. Excuse me for coming in late. I was next door testifying, so appreciate the opportunity to join. To piggyback on what Chip mentioned regarding the target critical investments, one of the proposals that the Governor has put forward is an increase in the corporate minimum. And in the proposal, as with the proposal that I know is coming forward from the Senate, it is focused on C corporations. But really the question is, why this critical investment? How are we targeting it? Organizations from AOI to the Ready for School group that is led by Dick Alexander and a number of other business leaders has identified that investing in Head Start and providing 100% access for current eligible students is a critical investment in this state. The research is clear that it provides a 17-to-1 return on investment. It is a smart business investment. We also target two other pieces that are connected to with the corporate minimum. The one is to ramp up our Oregon Opportunity Grants with the new shared responsibility model. Again, what we know to be a key component to allowing Oregonians to have access to a post-secondary education and training. For the first time, we'll be able to remove the barrier for Oregonians to say, we can't afford to pursue this, even though I may have both the intellectual capability as well as the desire and drive to pursue it. And then the third component is the what we call the skill-up program, so that we're talking about the early pipeline of future employees and workers in Oregon. We're talking about kind of the near-term future employees with the access to post-secondary. And then we also target the current workforce to make sure that they have an opportunity through the skill-up program to retrain and upgrade their skills. So throughout the system, while the individual benefits from a post-secondary education, the entity that receives the greatest benefit from this investment is the Oregon business community, because these are the workers and the future workers that will help Oregon remain competitive in the years to come. So that's why we tied the corporate minimum to the to those three programs.
Okay. For the record, my name's Alan Alley, and I'm the governor's deputy chief of staff, along with Tim. And I have to admit, the past couple of days have been somewhat of an out-of-body experience for me, but a good one. I'm really enjoying getting involved in the government in a way that I hope is meaningful for me, but especially meaningful for the state of Oregon and the people of Oregon. And it's interesting to see so many familiar faces as well. I hope we can collaborate and work together as we go forward. I had a couple of prepared comments I wanted to share with you first. First of all, speaking as a former CEO, it's rarely ever palatable to go to your shareholders and tell them you're making a decision that over the short term will lower earnings. Raising corporate taxes will have a negative short-term effect on earnings, but if the funds are used strategically and wisely, they will have a long-term effect of building our education system to be a magnet to keep, retain, and attract the best employees to our companies. I believe we're in the process of building a partnership with business where together we can make good decisions for all of our stakeholders, employees, shareholders, and Oregonians. Business leaders do recognize that excellence in education is our single most powerful weapon in the fight for global leadership. They understand we need to provide excellence and access for Oregonians, and that will cost money. On the other hand, they will hold us accountable for delivering it in the most efficient way possible, as benchmarked by world standards. But in the end, they understand the tremendous economic and competitive value of a top-tier educational system. During my years in Oregon, I've seen our legislators, governor, and business leaders collaborate to do some very progressive and innovative things. I'm looking forward to working with you, the governor, and the business leaders to help our kids get a head start and to help make college affordable for all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome, Alan. I don't know if we formally welcomed you. It's good to have you, and good to have you serving the state. I think we're often and poised for a really successful and ambitious five-month session. And it's impressive, I think, to see the governors. We've heard about the new staff, but this is the first time I think we've seen all four, and it's an impressive panel. So we're excited to get working. Questions for the panel? Yes, Senator George.
Thank you. The day after the election, I was in the building, and there was a meeting down in Hearing Room 50, and it was the Governor's Economic Development Commission. And they were talking about, you know, the minimum tax, which basically is a tax on your ability to lose money in Oregon, because if you were making money, you'd be paying tax. But the other thing that I found amazing was that they were suggesting in that meeting that there be a 37% reduction in tax for the higher income Oregonians and a sales tax, which would be on the backs mainly of the lower income Oregonians. Are you guys supporting what I heard that day in Hearing Room 50?
Let's see. I've been on the job for a month, and Tim's been on the job for a month, and Alan, this is your third day?
Third day.
Okay. So without knowing what was said specifically, what I can share with you is that regarding the corporate minimum, clearly that being in the governor's proposed budget, and that being, as I think Jim just discussed, really, I think an integral part of the fabric that we have outlined, that is very much a priority. And I would say that rather than characterizing the corporate minimum as a tax on businesses that don't make any money, that there is an intrinsic cost to supporting businesses just in doing business in Oregon. And that I would imagine just even the filing fees alone probably amount to, well, the filing costs alone amount to more than just $10, which is the current corporate minimum. The paperwork process alone is probably substantially more than that. And in 1931, it probably made a lot of sense for it to be $10. But we find that in today's dollars, I think the calculation was made about $130 would be the rough equivalent, if I'm not mistaken. So from the governor's proposed budget scenario, I can comment on the corporate minimum. In terms of the rest of that dynamic, I just am not familiar enough with it to be able to comment. If you're expecting a sales tax proposal out of the governor's office this session, I don't think you'll see that.
I can tell you where you could find it, but...
No, that's okay. Because the main thing, that was the governor's Economic Development Commission, and they were talking in that meeting of the Chambers of Commerce of Oregon going to go out and promote this tax increase. And what really bothered me was the tax on the lower income Oregonians in the form of a sales tax and a 37% reduction for the wealthiest members of our society, and that just really didn't sit very well with me, and that was what was being promoted in that meeting.
We'll go back and do a little research and get back to you on that.
Great, thanks.
You bet.
Thank you. Senator Monroe, and then Representative Tom Butler.
Thank you. Appreciate you gentlemen coming. And by the way, congratulations to those of you that are new on the job. I think the governor made some wise choices. You talked about health care and the needs there, and you talked about education and the needs there. There's another crisis in this state that I didn't hear any comments on, and that's the need for doubling the number of state troopers. The governor spoke to that in his budget, but I didn't hear any comments from you, and I wondered why that was the case.
What we wanted to do is quickly get to this discussion, which I think is, you know, kind of open up some of those. We just really chose two illustrations of how the governor's tried to apply the three principles that I mentioned in the formulation of revenue proposals, prudence, fairness, and then targeted critical investments. I think the governor's position around state troopers is very, very clear. There's a proposed insurance surcharge that's been discussed, but the real issue that the governor is I think articulated quite clearly is the need for dedicated funding for the state troopers. That the current instability of having them attached to the general fund has created a system that does not allow for 24/7 coverage on major arterials. And for the state troopers out there, the dedicated funding issue is very much a priority for this governor. So I want to be clear, just because we didn't mention it, we were just giving two illustrations, does not mean that that isn't a priority. It is.
Follow up?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I was on the House floor in 1979 when we debated whether or not to take the state troopers out of the highway fund. I opposed that move, but as you know, it happened. I predicted at that time that we would decry the day and that both parks and state troopers would suffer. Parks have been made whole by the lottery, but state troopers have continued to decline. I think it's a go-home issue for me personally. I think the governor's proposal for a surtax on auto insurance is something that I could personally support, but it doesn't have legs. Let's face it. It just doesn't have legs. I wondered if there's any other dedicated source of revenue that the governor would consider, such as an increase in the beer tax.
I think his statement really, the governor's statement probably said it best. If you have a better idea, I want to hear it.
I do.
Then we'd love to hear it.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, and I'm going to start off with a question to Alan regarding the statement relative to the short-term negative effect of implementing additional taxes on corporations for the long-term benefit and the good of what that tax is proposed to do. My concern is the same discussion that we just had with Senator Monroe, and that is, what of the dedication of this? One of the concerns that I have is that today it may be dedicated for the higher education component and bringing us on board with the goals that we've established in the innovation and higher technology in the state of Oregon. My concern is that the immediate next legislature, which is now scheduled for 2008, could come on board and say, yes, but we have a greater need over here. We want to take care of unwed mothers with several children or some other segment of society. I need a response to that whole issue of the dedication of these funds and where we see, you know, how we're going to be able to measure and matrix out success in that process.
Representative Butler, speaking as, I can't represent the governor's position on this, but I can give you a little bit of feedback, I think, from where the business community stands on it. I think you're hitting on a really important point, that the use of the funds is going to be critical to get support for this. The business community sees that the long-term benefit from higher education, from Head Start, from things directed toward education, because that is an investment in the future employees of these companies. If the funds are not dedicated and focused, I think it's going to be dramatically harder to gain broad support from the business community for something like this. I think you have an excellent point.
Follow-up.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a follow-up then, I have a concern, and this concern spans this entire, I think it was Tim that started the discussion relative to the reduction in tobacco tax. That was, I believe, Measure 30. And my concern about this whole process is that we get everything lined up and all of the dominoes in a row, and then voters come back and say, you know what, with a nearly 20% increase in the general fund, you're coming back for additional taxes on tobacco, additional taxes on corporations, additional taxes perhaps in the form of sales tax or use taxes or even an insurance premium tax, and we're going to refer it. Is there a plan B with regard to the 20% growth we've already anticipated in government if we can't get the additional resources that we're anticipating, or through a referendum, the voters just say no?
I guess let me also point out this, that the growth in overall resources in this biennium is about 17.9%. When you take out the kicker, the personal and the corporate kicker, that growth is reduced to about 7.5% in total resources. So the kicker right there just takes off a fairly hefty portion, 10.5% roughly, off the top in terms of potential savings that could be had, which is another reason why the corporate kicker discussion and the suspension of that is another thing that the governor has proposed, sticking that away for the very purposes that you just outlined.
Mr. Chair, we can debate about whether or not Paul's figures are correct or not. We'll do that another time. My concern is that we know that it's 19.65% that we'll actually have available to expend during this particular time. My concern is what happens when the voters say, you know, we just don't think that we want to go along with it. What's plan B?
And I think that Representative Butler, the real drive here is actually under the issue of fairness, and I think the desire of Oregon voters for tax fairness. And you will note that there is just the corporate kicker proposal and the corporate minimum proposal, and not a plethora of other proposals coming from the governor's office. It's limited really to those two particular pieces. The voters' tolerance and sense of urgency for those pieces is genuine, and I believe that they will be met should they end up at the ballot box well received.
Mr. Chair, I thought I heard a tobacco tax. Didn't I hear a tobacco tax? There's only two now. You've taken the tobacco tax off the table?
No, regarding the corporate.
Oh, I'm
pieces.
Sorry. Okay, yeah. Just the corporate tax. Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yeah, and just one point that we came across, and Paul, just grab me if I get this wrong, but yesterday on that 19.65 growth, we asked Paul to look into this because the question was posed, if we're not going to ramp up and spend all 19.65%, just go for it, kicker, just the whole thing, would we at that point even be in a growth from the cuts that were made in the 2001-03? And the answer came back yesterday that we would not have even caught up at that point. And so I think it's important to note that even if we didn't, I don't think we're going to do that, get to that 19 or 20% if you rounded it up. Even if you spent it all, you still would be negative from where you were at the turn of the century or just after that. Representative Rosenbaum and then Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I wanted to just respond to Representative Butler's comment, too, that when voters on ballot measure 30 voted down a cigarette tax increase, I don't think anybody thought they were actually rejecting the cigarette tax increase that was in there. And also in there was an increase in the corporate minimum tax. And I think had either of those been put in front of voters back then as standalone proposals, very few people questioned that they would have passed on their own. And it was the packaging that really was the death knell. I think it was a fairly cynical attempt by those who collected signatures, knowing that there were other features that wouldn't be as popular. So I would applaud you for picking out, I think, two changes that are really just almost embarrassments for our state right now, and that, you know, everyone I've talked to, not just in my own district, but really everywhere, says we need to address those. I guess my question to you would be, though, that there's a lot wrong with Oregon's tax system, and I think some people think we don't really even have a system. And so I'm wondering how you see these features fitting together. They certainly meet your principles, but one of the things that we talk a lot about here is a lack of stability long-term and these sort of dips and valleys that we keep taking. I know that the governor has talked about the need for a rainy day fund to be created, so I'm wondering what your thoughts are of how these proposals fit together with a long-term effort towards stability.
And do you want to take a question? Mr. Chair, as a representative, obviously with a level of reserves approaching $900 million, we will have a budget which is a lot more prudent and a lot more stable. Getting there, a big piece of that means directing the corporate kicker to reserves. I think that's a major step. I think we've always been sometimes daunted by how many more steps we'd like to take. But I think much as you'll hear in our discussion of health care reform, being able to move forward and take significant steps, I think, means we're moving forward and not that we're then giving up on the effort to have a comprehensive health care system in this country, just as we're not giving up on the effort to have a truly stable, adequate, and fair tax system. So I think we have to take it step by step, and I think what the governor has proposed, and he said this many times during the campaign, is where we now have this debate for many years and where citizens recognize that there has been something of an imbalance in our tax system, and we can correct it with a moderate increase in the corporate minimum, where there's been instability, and we can correct it by directing the corporate kicker to a rainy day fund. Where we have a need as compelling as health care for kids, and we have a tax which not only will reduce a major health care cost and a social problem, but also give us the resources to provide health care for kids. All these things make sense, and they're all they all represent significant progress towards our longer-term goals.
Chair of House Revenue, Phil Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one of the things that we've been talking about lately, and Chair Deckard brought this up, is the issue of the restoration of funds as a result of the increase in the economy. And I think it's important to point out that we're talking about, it depends on when you measure from. If you want to go back to the point at which the degradation of the education system began, which was in the early 90s, we all recall, I'm sure, the entrepreneurial sleight of hand that people like Dave Frommeyer pulled off in Eugene, trying to protect the University of Oregon from huge budget cuts in the mid-90s, that in fact the budget cut problem that the state faces now, and the degradation in the state police system and on, started with Measure 5 in 1990, a decade before the comment that Chair Deckard made. And that the things that we're talking about doing, or that the governor's talking about doing now, are extremely modest first steps in dealing with the changes in our overall state and local tax system that came about as a result of Measure 90, and the need for the state government to take on the major burden of funding the K-12 school system. I think when we look at these issues from a historical perspective, and 10 years or 15 years ago doesn't feel historical to me, but for some people apparently it is, we recognize that this is not a substantial increase in the budget. In fact, it's the beginning of a recovery from very serious budget cuts. If we want a state police system that functions appropriately, we want a university system that the business community can recognize as being able to take care of our economics in the future, and so forth and so on, we have to start moving in the direction of restoring the lost funding that came about as a result of Measure 90. Measure 5 in 1990. And that isn't really a question. It's more of a comment about it. And I don't believe anyone should apologize for the fact that there's a small uptick in the revenue this time. It's simply a result of the economic recovery, and it's not a result of any repairs that we've made in the tax system that we have now.
Senator George.
Thank you. I have a limitless revenue source for you. Oregon Public Broadcasting delivered a videotape, a DVD, to my office, and I played that videotape, and I have to tell you, I was almost in shock, because in this video, it was former Governor John Kitzhaber talking about the abuse and misuse of the forest, along with a bunch of other folks, and right now, you guys know, with dead, dying, and tipped over timber. I mean, hundreds of thousands of trees have gone down during these winter storms in the Coast Range. You could fund education for the next who knows how many years if you guys would help us
to free up some of the regulations to allow immediate recovery of that timber. And on the east side, we're talking about the very survival of that timber. With the insect and disease problems that are over there, the very idea that we're almost down to the point now there are no mills that could operate. Is the governor willing to take a look at this? Because I don't think anyone can look at Oregon forests without saying this is a massive disaster, an unlimited source of revenue.
Senator, I think the governor is willing to look at forest policy. He's very much focused on what makes sense from the point of view of these new win-win proposals we have as well for clearing the forest floor and dedicating some of the of that material to biofuels sector. And I think Alan Alley is going to be applying his expertise to a lot of those efforts as well. I'm not sure that the magnitude of the revenue you envision is, in fact, great enough to do all that you hope it would. But I think there's obviously new possibilities for the management of our forests, and I think we're going to be looking to be as creative as possible and in conjunction with good stewardship of that that resource as well.
In this video, the experts said that there's actually been a degradation of habitat for the spotted owl, which was the source. A good friend of mine, Tim Josie, now county commissioner, former legislator, yesterday made a point that he and I, when we were running in 1990, debated the spotted owl and what was going to be the implication. We had no idea how big this was going to be. Nor did we, would have either of us have ever believed that we would end up in 2007 with a degradation of spotted owl habitat. And the reason is dead, dying, burned, and now tipped over habitat trees. So I think it's a win-win for everyone if you're a radical environmentalist or a common sense conservationist. Then what the situation should be is let's get in there and manage this resource. Is there a commitment to manage from the governor's office? Manage. We're talking about sustainability here. We're not talking about clear-cut cutting the forest.
Senator, we have plans to do that. And Representative Witt, who was my colleague some years ago and served on the Board of Forestry, I think is probably one of the best persons to answer the question about the effectiveness of our state forest plans. And they are different than the federal policies. Let's remember that. I think we've done an excellent job, and I always thought the Board of Forestry did an excellent job with the plan they came up with for the Tillamook. It has not produced all of the returns that were expected, so I think there'll be another look at that. This is a question where I think we have to balance, obviously, the needs short-term and long-term of our state and the resource potential short-term and long-term for that resource.
Representative Witt, do you care to comment? Or
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that as Mr. Nesbitt has pointed out, that there are some options available to us for management, but that there is a considerable concern from many sectors, and we have to recognize that we're managing timber on behalf of the public, that there are multiple demands on our resources, and that our state Department of Forestry, with oversight from our state Board of Forestry, I think manages timber better than any organization in our nation, and certainly is recognized internationally for, excuse the pun, for some of the cutting-edge technology and approaches that it uses for timber management. And with that said, they have developed forest plans for our state forests that enable us to get considerably more timber off of our state forest than one would ordinarily expect, at the same time managing for characteristics of old growth forests, which then take care of some of the needs of our other resource needs. And it's not management strictly for age of timber, but rather characteristics. And it is that kind of management regimen that allows us then to get the maximum amount of timber off of our state forests. Certainly, I don't think there really are very many folks that want to leave deadening, dying timber
in our forests. And I think that reasonable people can get together and find a common solution that fits everyone's needs there. Because certainly, as the senator has pointed out, there is a waste of resources there. There's a potential for further forest fires. There's a potential for bug infestations. There are all kinds of potentials that leads to. But again, the Department of Forestry's management regimen that they have laid out is one that I think will be able to accommodate the needs of those of us who would like to see that timber taken care of, as well as the multiple needs and uses of our state's forests. We truly are doing a good job in this state.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chief of Staff.
Mr. Chair, Senator George,
you see me shaking my head.
I know.
That's right.
No.
I'm a lousy poker player, too.
That makes two of us.
Yeah, I can confirm that on one.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
A story for another day.
Let's hope not. Senator George's question, I think, in this discussion has actually sort of touched on, I think, another issue that's worthy of just putting out on the table. It's tangentially related, but I think it's worth a conversation. And that relates to the issue of county payments and the federal reauthorization of county payments. We know that the timeline on that is May 1st. And we know that right now Congress is just beginning to sort of awaken to the issue. And I will tell you that the governor is leading the charge on this on a multi-state strategy, getting together a broad coalition of players from the business community, labor, and a host of others, because I think all of you are probably aware of the potential implications should that not come to fruition in May, whether it's transportation, whether it's schools. It is a dramatic impact. So I just want to put that on the table as an issue for further consideration and discussion down the road.
Yes, Representative White.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. And I would point out that I would hope that our federal government could take a lesson from the state of Oregon in how to properly manage its forests and our timber supply.
Hear, hear.
One other question. So, Alan, and kind of where in your pixel works or OBC, what was attractive about Oregon when you were deciding to locate here, grow here, and what were the challenges that you saw?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I started investing in Oregon in 1988 with the first investment that I did in Focus Systems when I was in the venture capital business. And there were several things. One was the display cluster itself, going back to Tektronix, Planar, Sharp Labs, not in Oregon, but located near Oregon. And there aren't very many places in the world that have a center of expertise around display technology, flat panel display technology, going back into the, with Tektronix, going back into the 60s and 70s. In fact, it was about 1988-89, I actually had a Japanese executive tell me that some of the most innovative work in liquid crystal development was being done in Oregon at that time. Now, the thing that breaks my heart is when I go to Korea and I go to the Samsung LCD fabs that are now built in Korea, and the scale of these fabs are literally unimaginable. Multiple football fields in size and footprint and 7-8 stories tall, building 30% of the liquid crystals that we now use in all of the flat panel televisions in the world. And that trend is just a juggernaut that's going to continue. Much of that innovative work was seeded by things that we were doing here in Oregon. In fact, I've often lamented that we gave up on the consumer electronics business here in the United States 40 years ago. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but the branded televisions that you now see that are RCA and GE and Westinghouse and Zenith None of those have American content. They're not even American companies. They're American brands that were built by Americans over 30 or 40 years. And then we decided that those were low-margin businesses, and we didn't want to be in that business, and we exited those businesses. The flip side of that is, if we hadn't, we might not have Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft. So I'll leave that debate. That's a debate that we can have at some other point in time. I think the other thing about Oregon that attracted us was a perception of a very high-quality, well-educated workforce with an environment that was that we could attract people from all over the world and all over the country, and that their children would have a great education system. And that was the perception in 1988. It was a perception in the 1990s. I think that perception has changed. And that's one of the things that, if we're going to be a global leader, we've got to change. We have to change that perception that I think people do not believe that we have a leading world-class education system. And when I say that, I mean K through 12 and higher ed also. I think there's an awakening and awareness in the state, and I think we all have begun to recognize that. We might not be in this exactly the same position on the spectrum of where we think we are, but I'm heartened by the fact that most everybody I talk to recognizes this. We may differ on the solution or how we're going to fund the solution, but I think we're all working in the right direction.
Thank you. Well, that is a good ending point. Any other questions? Well, there they are, the governor's team, for the upcoming session. We'll get to work with them more, but we appreciate them coming and setting the table for our work in finance and revenue, and appreciate your time and the ideas and the energy that you've put forth.
Thank you.
Mr. Barnhart, anything
for me?
Thank you. Paul, you have all of us all in one place. Anything that we need to impart to the House Committee or the Senate Committee before we meet again? We're going to meet, I think, next week, same time, same place.
I have one brief thing for each committee.
Great.
So the other committee could not listen with him. For the Senate, you've got your schedule for next week, so Senate members have that. So that's, we're set for Monday through Thursday. We do have another joint or simultaneous meeting next Thursday. We've invited in a couple of economists have confirmed. Richard Sims will be here. He's worked for a number of states, has worked closely with Oregon Education Association, Oregon Business Council, and he's going to kind of give us a perspective on overall business taxation issues. And we've also asked Phil Romero to come in, who from the University of Oregon, who spent time working for Governor Wilson in California. So you'll get some different perspectives kind of on overall policy. The other thing I'd mentioned for the House is a reminder we have our meeting at 1 o'clock today, so we'll meet at our regular time.
Okay. Are we done for now? I think we're concluded. Representative Rosenbaum?
No, I was just waiting for the simultaneous gavels to fall.
Tom had to lead. Representative Butler always had to lead.
The House Revenue Committee will recess until 1 o'clock.
We're adjourned.